Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining us for today's SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup for February 3rd, 2021. And for this, the shortest month of the year, we're going to be taking a look at some very complex issues in the world of international education today. And we hope we'll do some justice to them with the three questions that we're going to ask this afternoon, this morning, or this evening, wherever you are. And before we get to that, though, we do want to give our newcomers to the Midweek Roundup a chance to get a sense for what we do here at SMIE Consulting. In addition to the services we provide to individual institutions and various service providers, we also do a weekly newsletter on Mondays called All the SMIE News Fit to Share, and that's social media, SM, and international ed news, IE, fit to share. So that newsletter comes out Monday morning at 9 a.m. in your inboxes, and it has stories from both social media and international ed news, and often where those two areas overlap, and how my thoughts on how those particular news stories impact what we do in international education. We also provide today on the roundup an in-depth look at three of the themes that run through those news stories each week. And we go a little bit more in depth, spend some time breaking the stories down and saying what, discussing what some of the implications might be in the form of answering questions. So much like our Jeopardy friend Alex Trebek, who's passed on recently and looking for his replacement now, we'll start asking the kinds of questions that we think will be relevant answers for you in your roles in international ed. So shout out to those watching live here on Facebook, but also those watching on repeat on our Facebook page for SMIE Consulting, on our YouTube channel, on our playlist for international ed chats, as well as those that are listening on podcasts. And thank you again for those who have downloaded and subscribed to our podcast. We've now had over 1,000 podcast listens, downloads over the last year and a half. So thanks so much for making us a part of your weekly listening journey. So let's get right to it. First question up is, will a focused ask from an international ed perspective work? And this is always, for anyone who's done advocacy work or been to meet with congressional representatives or had a plan advocate for your profession more in what you do through the free time that you might have. Advocacy efforts, whether it's through NAFSA, the Alliance for International Educational Exchange, always has as its focus, and anybody who lobbies on the Hill knows this, is that you have to have or go in with a particular ask. And this is something that I've had the pleasure of doing at several times in my professional career, visiting my congressional representatives on Capitol Hill to lobby for international ed-related concerns. Did that both as a consortia with Destination Indiana back in the 2000s, meeting with one of our senators, Richard Lugar, who's since passed, a real icon in international ed circles on the Republican side. As well as elected representatives, depending on where I was living at the time, meeting with them in small groups or one-on-one to discuss my concerns. So the power of the people in action through advocacy, and those are arranged by a lot of times groups like NAFSA and the Alliance and other organizations. So it's incumbent upon us all, I think, in the profession to be advocates for not only our students, but ourselves and our colleagues in the field. To help make people aware on our campuses, in elected officials, and other positions of authority of what we do and how what we do impacts the economy, impacts our communities, impacts our students on our campus, everybody. So as part of that, ACE, American Council on Education, has been kind of the umbrella group for a number of associations, certainly when the travel bans came out in the Trump administration, early in the Trump administration, ACE and a group of higher ed associations rallied behind in support of overturning those bans, and numbers of individual colleges, presidents, high-profile presidents did the same thing as well. What ACE has done now is a very specific ask to the new Secretary of State, Blinken, Anthony Blinken, It was in the Obama administration, State Department, and has now been nominated and approved as the Secretary of State for the Biden administration. And so what's important here, I think, to keep in mind is this ACE is the umbrella organization, so to speak, for the undersigned other association members of everything from ACT, ACRO, ASCU, APLU, American Association of Colleges and Universities, the Jesuit Association, Catholic Colleges and Associations, Community Colleges, all of these things. You've got Common App in there, you've got NAFSA, you've got all the accrediting agencies, NACAC, all of those are members of this. So this association, and they've come up with two specific apps. One of them is not quite specific, but very specific, but it does certainly, these are two apps of the Biden administration when it comes to international ed. The first of which is, in coordination with the Department of Homeland Security, and I'm reading from the letter, ensure the timely and efficient processing of visa applications and work authorizations for international students and scholars. As you may know, both agencies have current funding issues due to the extremely low number of applications processed in 2020 and loss of those fees, as well as cuts made to DHS and state workforces over the past 4 years. Both state and DHS need additional resources to ramp up processing of an authorization post-COVID-19. So let's take a look at that one first. For those who aren't aware, the application fees from OPT applications, from all the other various applications that DHS deals with, and particularly USCIS deals with, they're part of their congressional mandate for when they were set up, was they had to be self-sustaining. CVIS, it's as the database for international students, is self-sustaining based on the fees generated by CVIS fees. For consulates and embassies overseas, U.S. consulates and embassies overseas, they generate revenue to support staffing and other issues through the visa fees that they take in. And as a result, that has impacted their staffing levels or their processing times and so forth. So what's happened is a number of things over the past few years, not just within the Trump administration, but you've seen levels of funding decreased. You've seen staff cuts, as this alludes to. So this particular one involves not just state, but also DHS, this ask from ACE. And part of it is really a look at what U.S. needs to do to put itself in a better position to better respond in a more timely fashion to international students who are already here looking to take advantage of the benefits that they do have as regulations permit with work authorization and such. And also where there have been massive delays in processing OPT applications. That's nothing new to any ISSS officer or advisor that's watching this or listening. Certainly, it really puts the students in very awkward positions with regards to their employers as to when they can start. They've been offered a job 2 months ago, and we're hoping to have work permission in hand in order to start when they could apply, no more than 120 days before the start of their proposed training. So there's actually 90 days, excuse me. So that's something that we look at as real challenges that our international students have in terms of being able to take advantage of those benefits and in relation to their work, or their relationship with employers and universities that have them in legal status. So that's a real challenge for us in international ed circles, international student advising circles. So certainly I'm all on board with that. Staffing and processing times are massively important on the USCIS side that handles the OPT applications and other work authorizations, H-1Bs as well. So which actually go through Department of Labor, so I'll take that back. The other side of that is with regard to Department of State. Our consulates and embassies, they generate fees by the DS-160 fee and over and above the DS-160 fees that they charge. They get to use for staffing for consular visa officers, at their embassies and consulates. And that has been a real challenge this year, in that in many countries they're still not open fully for visa processing, for student visa processing. That's changing, and more will be opening up soon. But their budgets for the fiscal year that started in October were based on what they'd raised the previous year. And with this past year, in terms of visa processing, was way down for across the board. In some countries, 90% down, 98% down in China, 64% down, or 84% down in India, our two largest sending countries to the United States for students. So the money that they have available for consular officers, staffing in embassies and consulates, and as well as accommodating for social, for COVID procedures in particular countries, that's something that will impact them this year. So they, DHS, state, they need a stimulus package because they're self-sustaining funds. They're supposed to be self-operating. Their operating funds are supposed to be self-generated. That they haven't had the revenue to generate the funds necessary to handle the staffing that we want to have in place when a rush of new student visa applicants comes this summer. And that's the expectation, is that there is going to be a bigger rush. Can't get any smaller than it was this past year, but it's certainly in the normal student visa processing time between May and August, September. We need consulates and embassies up and running and fully staffed to be able to handle the student visa processing numbers that are going to be coming, and they will be coming. Let's be confident, let's be positive, and let's think that we're going to rebound successfully here. And we've talked a little bit about how that's going to happen anyway, I think, with a pent-up interest that a lot of folks have talked about. But we'll look at that more specifically in the weeks and months to come as we get closer to student visa season. The other part, the second ask from ACE and the other undersigned higher ed associations, is to restore the 2005 Rice Cable that allows flexibility for consular officers in interpreting an international student's intent provisions when adjudicating student visa applications. Ideally, the administration could push Congress to enact legislation that would allow for dual intent. That's the ideal situation. Then when international students apply for a non-immigrant visa. Dual intent is already allowed on some non-immigrant visas, such as H-1B, and that's certainly what I would hang my head on if I'm making this argument. And expanding dual intent to include F visas would streamline the visa process for international students and allow students the ability to express interest in remaining in the United States after their studies. So that Rice memo is from Condoleezza Rice when she was Secretary of State, that gave consular officers under the Bush administration, gave consular officers in the field the ability to be flexible in how they interpreted the 214B requirements in the regulations that says the student must prove the negative, that they are not planning to immigrate to the United States. And that's always been clear from anyone who's worked with an 18-year-old who knows exactly what they want to do for the rest of their life or when they finish a degree, things change. And to expect that an 18-year-old knows exactly what they're going to do, be able to articulate that effectively in a second or third or fourth language, and say and document that they're going to be able to return home once they're done with their time in the U.S. So this, I love this idea, and certainly it's one that has a lot of merit in my mind as a significant step forward to put us more in line, frankly, with other major sending countries that do allow for the visa categories that these students in to not be limited to just that student visa category or a non-immigrant category. It's not labeled as such, so that Canadian students or international students going to Canada know that going in that there's a pathway for them if they wish to pursue it that would allow for work and then study after studies have finished. We also look at what happens in the UK. They now have their two-year work post-study work visa available. Australia and New Zealand have very similar pathways. So this is something that I think is very important. If the U.S. can up its game, frankly, on international education circles to better compete against other major receiving countries, That's part of what we talk about here at SMIE all the time, about how we all need a change of perspective in the United States to recognize that we're in a global fight for international students and a battle. And depending on the competitive advantages different countries have in any given moment, this is one area that pulls us back in the United States, is there isn't a seamless, readily identifiable pathway that doesn't require many hoops for individual students to jump through if they want to secure that benefit. So that Rice, restoring the Rice Cable would be a fantastic addition to this ask, for what the Biden administration can, and we would hope in the field certainly should do. So that would be a big step forward for our field, and I think has a lot of potential if it goes the way we hope. So there's no indication yet on either of those where the Biden administration certainly would stand. Certainly you would think, based on current executive orders that have been put in place related to immigration, looking to make the process more open and friendly, that these two would be seen as easier to adopt. Certainly the congressional action on changing the regulations to make it F1 to be a dual intent category certainly make a lot of sense to me. Certainly isn't going to be possible to do that with J's, since they're exchanges. They're not meant to be a transitional piece to immigrant status. So for F's, that's where the bulk of that regulation change that would require congressional approval would need to happen. But something in the interim, like the Rice Cable reintroduction, would be welcome. The funding pieces for DHS and for states to allow them to have the staffing that they need, particularly to address the issues that we're talking about here, work authorization processing and other USCIS processing details, as well as visa processing out at consulates and embassies in the field. Those are things that we want to make sure from an international ed side get addressed. So perfect steps, I think, taken by ACE in terms of the two major asks. There are others, obviously, that a lot of us in our dream of dreams would have for international ed to be made more concrete. And we'll talk about one of those in our second question of the day. But certainly kudos to ACE for gathering and rallying the troops to get this ask out relevant folks in the government. And this letter that I'm posting a link to on our Facebook page is going to this new Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, and similar ones will go to the newly confirmed DHS secretary, I think, in the coming days, if not already. So that's the first question of the day. Let's move on to number two. Does the data support giving international PhDs green cards? Now, this is something that we've seen is not a new idea, frankly, and it's one that was actually at one point was proposed by President Trump, but and certainly no one was really taking him seriously at that point when he would say that he would give this benefit to PhD graduates, international PhD graduates. So there's great recently just been produced in an article published in Science that actually does support, and President Biden has said he would like to make this happen, to give green cards to international PhD graduates. The Science article did some research into STEM doctorates from 39 leading research universities, along with data from Department of Labor. And they concluded that H-1B, this is from the article in Inside Higher Ed, a temporary skilled worker visa open to workers with a bachelor's degree or higher, has become the predominant first step for STEM PhDs employed in industrial research and development, not because it is legally required or the most suitable visa, but because of inefficiencies and delays on the path to permanent residencies. And the main article and the articles that are supporting this, there's a couple of them that I'll be posting the links to, that are same articles or covering the same topic about STEM PhDs. Now, this article is specific to STEM PhDs, but it does have a lot to do. I think it really is important to take this into consideration when you look at what's happened. This is just the STEM at this point, PhDs, not all PhDs. I think Biden wants to address it to all PhDs to have that green card staple on, because frankly, they are the pathway to it shortcuts the H-1B process by keeping STEMs, keeping STEM PhDs, giving them that immediate pathway to permanent residency. And I think that's something that would go a long way, as we were talking about earlier, with the dual intent piece. If this is if this is made available to international STEMs, it's going to make it a much more robust pathway for international students who want to come to the United States and stay and work and do research or teach in the United States. So I think this is a fantastic idea. There are two separate articles from Inside Higher Ed that address this, and I'm sharing both of those with you in the comments section here on the Facebook page for SMIE Consulting. So excuse me while I'm just making sure those links do get into the comments section here. So great to it's a great topic, and I think as an ask, it's certainly, I think it does have bipartisan support, frankly, and should be a fairly easy way to make a difference and give us a competitive advantage again that other countries have now, or make it an easier process. But having that as a carrot for any graduate department in a PhD program, for these cases, STEM PhD programs, how significant of a recruiting tool that would be for those departments to be able to say, hey, we can offer you, if you're admitted to our institution, you complete your degree here, you're going to have permanent residency when you're done. And that is for an international student now that has to go through that process in terms of the years of study, working H-1B, securing H-1B after that. Maybe they have to do OPT first, then H-1B, 6 years of that, and then maybe they can then get permanent residency or be sponsored by their company for permanent residency. So that's something I think is just a remarkably easy thing. If this administration is serious about supporting international education and keeping the best and the brightest here, that's something I think we would support in international education. There are obvious concerns about brain drain that would be the counterpoint to this, these outstanding leaders aren't going back to their home countries. Certainly folks in the State Department would probably see that as a public diplomacy fail if we're keeping them here. But so they're balancing issues, competing issues, I should say, in the government necessarily. But I think at the highest levels, when it as a country that is founded on immigration, we are a nation of immigrants, all of us. We are, I think, honor bound to give those that want to stay the opportunity to stay, who are going to be some of the most talented people that can really enrich our society. So. Enough for that on question two. And finally, this is coming out, this topic or question here is one that I, one of my friends in England, who is a big international ed thinker, certainly has a lot of broad perspectives on not only UK higher ed and internationalization efforts there, but also globally. So someone who I consider a good colleague, his name is Alan Preece. He has his own company and has a blog site for his thoughts called View from a Bridge. And that is, it's really, really something I've certainly been reading a lot of his articles, and I've shared some of them in the newsletter in the past. But this is certainly one I want to make sure it serves as an important discussion item, because it lends that perspective that I was talking about earlier, that in the U.S. we need to have for what our competition are doing, frankly, when it comes to international education, and that we don't exist, what we do in the U.S. does not exist in a vacuum when it comes to international students who have now at this point many different options in terms of where they can study around the world, whether it be in one of the major English-speaking destination countries or programs in certain countries like Germany, like Netherlands, like China, that have English language programs that can be done fully in English in those countries for a four-year degree or a three-year degree, depending on what the program is. So Alan's main article that I'm his blog article that serves as the foundation for this discussion and this question is Fatal Four-Way Match for Universities. And that's the title for it. And what he's basically getting at is that we're all every country has been affected differently by COVID-19 in terms of their international ed strategies. We've seen countries like Australia, New Zealand, China shut down completely, and Australia is reopening the faucet slightly. There's only a trickle coming in, and very few, and not the hundreds of thousands that are normally expected each year. New Zealand generally gets over 20,000 students a year, and they're going to be lucky if they get 10,000 this year re-entering. It's because they've had their countries and China as well. They still are not letting international students back in to return to studies or new students to come physically to campus to begin their programs. They've been forced to do, if they wanted to attend still the universities in China. They've been forced to go online. Australia and New Zealand, similarly, they've had online education opportunities to at the start of their academic programs. So Canada had basically shut down to anyone who didn't have a visa before March, study permit, I should say. And they opened it up for the fall that students could come in if they had visas before March, but only if their campuses were requiring them to be on campus. Their colleges would be requiring them there. So that wasn't happening for most of them. Now that they've reopened in October to students to come, visas have been processed, that it's possible that they can come for studies if their institutions have government-approved readiness, COVID readiness plans, and there's been backlogs in that process, which we've talked about. In the UK, they seem to have come out better than most in terms of their admission of international students to campus this past fall, and that has led them to be seeing some significant upticks in enrollments that most countries, certainly the top six international ed destinations, were not seeing. UK certainly saw that this fall. Everyone else has either saw just a trickle or significantly reduced numbers. So what Alan is making the argument for in his piece is that when you look at what's four major destination countries, and for him it's Australia, UK, Canada, and Australia, and certainly in the English-speaking world those are the top four by far. China's programs have pushed them up to two or three in that list in terms of international student destinations, but the English-speaking world goes, these are the four that we're talking about: US, UK, Australia, Canada. Canada has obviously made huge leaps and bounds over the last few years. They're at a point now where their numbers have been going up dramatically over the last decade. Australia has rebounded well in the last few years. New Zealand, not in this conversation, but they've also seen growth. UK, as we talked about, they've seen the best results this fall. But each of the four have significant issues that they're still grappling with in terms of ability to reopen completely. Australia, and I'll post a link to the latest story there, doesn't look like they're going to have significant numbers coming this year at all. Certainly, it'll be a trickle. It's interesting that they've remained closed to new international student visitors, returning international students coming back to the country. But they were able to open for the Australian Open, their major tennis event each year, which has had up to 30,000 people maskless in stadiums, open-air stadiums, watching tennis matches. But they won't open the doors to international students yet. So interesting the way that's developing in Australia. And certainly I'd love to hear some feedback from my colleagues down under about how that's being received in the international ed circles. You've seen the UK, though they have had a lot of success in terms of numbers this fall, it has had some knock-on consequences at institutions where international students haven't perhaps been at the front of the queue for services. Because they've lost revenue, have had to cut back. They're also dealing in the UK with post-Brexit implications for EU students that might be coming to campus and what the reductions there would mean. So Canada has had basically closed borders until October, and there are some challenges now in terms of getting them back up to speed. They're requiring COVID testing and quarantine immediately after arrival, so that at the traveler's expense. So U.S. has been open, hasn't had really any significant restrictions until the recent requirement for COVID testing before departure that had to be documented before travelers could get on planes. But there may be other ones coming for future COVID testing, if not after arrival, certainly before they come. That's already in place. So 2021 is still kind of a crapshoot for how things are going to shake out. But as we move forward, certainly it's going to be one that we'll pay attention to in looking to 2022, when I think we'll when vaccinations are fully rolled out and people are feeling secure in that, and to travel again, which for my money isn't going to happen at all in 2021 internationally in any significant numbers, certainly not recruitment travel. But we'll talk more about that in the coming weeks as we get closer to peak visa season for us in the U.S. But certainly in terms of 2022, Alan's point is that all these countries are putting together the pieces that will make them a much more competitive proposition for international students in 2022. So we'll see what that looks like, and we'll keep tracking that. But a great article, if you have the time to read it, certainly recommend. Until next time, that's all from us here at the Midweek Roundup, and we're looking forward to chatting with you again soon. Cheers.